My name is Andrew Pappas. I'm the president of the Los Angeles Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society, and this afternoon it's my privilege to welcome and introduce our keynote speaker, John Allison. John Allison is the president and CEO of the Cato Institute. Prior to joining Cato, Mr. Allison was the chairman and CEO of BB&T Corporation, the 10th largest financial services holding company headquartered in the United States. During his tenure as CEO from 1989 to 2008, BB&T grew from $4.5 billion to $152 billion in assets. He was recognized by the Harvard Business Review as one of the top 100 most successful CEOs in the world over the last decade. Mr. Allison has received the Corning Award for Distinguished Leadership, has been inducted into the North Carolina Business Hall of Fame, and received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Banker. He is the author of The Financial Crisis and the Free Market Cure, Why Pure Capitalism is the World Economy's Only Hope, and this book, The Leadership Crisis and the Free Market Cure, Why the Future of Business Depends on the Return to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. And if you haven't already picked up a copy of this book, I would encourage you to do so. Copies are available where you registered. In addition, Mr. Allison is a former distinguished professor of practice at Wake Forest University School of Business and serves on the board of visitors at the business schools at Wake Forest, Duke, and UNC Chapel Hill. Mr. Allison is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He received his master's degree in management from Duke University and is also a graduate of the Stonier Graduate School of Banking. Mr. Allison is the recipient of 6 honorary doctorate degrees. So without further ado, Mr. Allison.
Well, thanks, Andrew. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I've always enjoyed having the opportunity to be with the Federalist Society. I think as a group and an organization, you do some very important work defending the principles that are necessary for a free society. I want to talk a minute about Cato, and then I want to tell you the purpose of my overall presentation. Cato is the world's leading libertarian think tank. Our mission is to create a free and prosperous society based on the principles of individual liberty, free markets, limited government, and peace. We really do believe in limited government. We think the government ought to stay out of your pocketbook, but we also think the government should stay out of your bedroom. We think that the purpose of government, which is both very important but also extremely limited, is to protect individual rights. Is to keep me from using force or fraud to take what you've earned and to keep you from using force or fraud to take what I've earned. In that context, we think government should provide for the national defense. We should have an effective police force, and we should have an excellent court system. In fact, in our world, we'd have 98% less of the regulations and a much more effective and efficient court system than we have today. The reason that we think government should be very limited is because it has a special role. It has a gun. It has the sanction to use force. And anybody that can use force is very dangerous. In fact, throughout human history, next to old age and disease, governments have killed more people than any other source. Governments have killed hundreds of millions of people throughout history. They're very dangerous. We also believe fundamentally, and this is intuitively in your own experience, any associations created by force are less effective than associations created voluntarily. So since government is force, its associations are much less likely to be effective than voluntary associations. So that's the context in which I'm going to share with you what being in Washington, D.C. now is made very visible to me, and I talk about in my book. I think there's a philosophic fight going on for the future of America, and the outcome of this fight will have a profound impact on the quality of life for you and particularly for your children and grandchildren. On one side are the classical liberals and the libertarians, who I will talk about in a minute, and the other side are the statists of all stripes. The statists are people that believe that highly educated elitists, typically in Washington, D.C., know what's good for you, and that those people will act in the common good, and that most people really can't take care of themselves. They need somebody to take care of them, and they need some guidance. Now, those statists are on both sides of the political spectrum. There are plenty of statists on the right. Many of those statists want to control your personal life, your social life. Statists on the left typically are more interested in controlling your money, your economic life. I'm going to talk about the left-wing statists because they're the most visible today, the progressives, as illustrated by the Obama administration. The progressives really believe that we can create a better world through the guidance of people that are elitists and know what's good for us. And they have underlying their political philosophy three fundamental philosophical pillars: altruism, collectivism, and egalitarianism. Altruism is not benevolence. Benevolence is a good thing. Altruism is otherism. It says that everybody's important but you. Everybody's important but you. The problem with that is there are only but yous, right? There's you and you and you and you. There isn't anybody but you. And when in that kind of world, individuals don't matter. The collective matters. The group matters. And they believe that they can act for the good of the group in what they call the common good. Here's the dilemma. The common good is an oxymoron. There's practically nothing that is equally good for everyone. And if there is, we're going to not argue about that, right? Almost everything is good for me, not so good for you, good for you, not so good for me, or not equally good for all of us. There is no such thing as a common good. In the real world, then, what that means, it becomes the good of my group, the good of the labor union, the good of big business, the good of my sex, my race, my business. And we have group warfare going on in Washington, D.C., always, of course, each group claiming that is the common good. It's really good for everybody, as determined through group eyes. Underlying this collectivist mindset is a very different view of justice than probably most people in this room have. And your view of justice has a tremendous impact on what you think are right public policies. And progressives in particular are egalitarians. Now, this is interesting. The United States is fundamentally an egalitarian society in a certain sense. All men are created equal. However, the founding fathers were talking about equality before the law. Just because you were the son of a baron didn't give you any special rights. The progressives are talking about a very different kind of egalitarian. They're talking about equal outcome. Well, it's true that everybody should be equal before the law, and it's true that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect because they're human beings. It is not true that everybody's equal. In fact, I have never met two equal people. Every person in this room is unique. Every person in this room has different strengths, different weaknesses, different goals, different ambitions. We're all unique, special individuals. That's the good news. That's what makes human life interesting and exciting. But we're not equal. We're different. At the extreme, Thomas Edison and the Boston Strangler are not equal. Because people are not equal, the only way to get equal outcomes is to use force, to take what somebody else has created and give it to somebody else who has not created it. That's what egalitarianism looks like in the real world. Let me concretize that for you. This will tell you a little bit about my age and where I went to school. One of my heroes was Michael Jordan. I thought Michael Jordan was not only a great basketball player, I thought he was a real inspiration to poor kids. Now, this will surprise you, but I am not as good a basketball player as Michael Jordan. There's a serious differential in performance. What's interesting is I can't get to be as good a basketball player as Michael Jordan. I don't care how hard I tried, how hard you tried to help me, I cannot be as good a basketball player as Michael Jordan. Can't be done. You cannot make the average great. You can make the average better. That may be a very productive, very noble thing to do. But you cannot make the average great. However, you can make the great average. Egalitarians, by definition, have to be in the business of making the great average. It's very easy to make Michael Jordan as good a basketball player as me. Just cut his legs off. You say we wouldn't do that? I don't know. We've been pretty tough on great people throughout human history. You know, poison Socrates, imprison Galileo, burn Joan of Arc. We're more sophisticated now. We would do it with balls and chains. 1% of the taxpayers pay 25% of the taxes. 5% of the taxpayers pay over 50% of the taxes. 50% of the taxpayers pay no taxes. A great way to run a democracy. We have lots of balls and chains on great people. What people fail to realize is great people make a disproportionate contribution to human well-being. Everybody in this room, your children and grandchildren, have a better life thanks to Thomas Edison. He not only invented the light bulb, he invented electrical generation, the research laboratory itself. Put balls and chains on great people and reduce the quality of life for all of us. Egalitarians like to claim the moral high ground because who can argue against everybody being equal? And whoever owns the moral high ground wins the fight. You can spend all the time arguing policy and economics, but people are driven by their ethical perceptions. Interestingly enough, egalitarians don't have the moral high ground. Because what motivates egalitarians is the most destructive of all human emotions, and watch it in yourself. It's called envy. It's hatred of the good for being the good. Very destructive emotion. And by the way, egalitarianism is a lot worse than I just described. Because any attribute, intelligence, mechanical ability, whatever, half the people, by definition, are below average. So if you want everybody to be equal, the equal point is way below average, right? I'll concretize that. I grew up in the Baptist church, and in the Baptist church, they want everybody to sing, except me. I was the one guy in the church. They said, please don't sing. You do not want to be as bad a singer as me, and you don't want the world to be as bad a singer as me. So egalitarianism is a very destructive idea. By the way, if you talk to progressives, because how nasty that looks, they'll say, well, that's not exactly what we mean. They'll say stuff like, what we really mean is equal opportunity. You know, equal opportunity is another oxymoron. I wasn't born with as good a legs as Michael Jordan. Some people are born with smarter. Some people are born with mechanical skills. We're all born with different attributes. We don't have equal opportunities. We have the opportunities we make with whatever Mother Nature gives us. That's an oxymoron. The other thing that progressives don't realize, but you see it, is what that mindset of this collective good under this egalitarian sense of right leads to is power lusters, right? They use that as a moral justification to seize power. That's an Elizabeth Warren. That's an exactly a person that rides on that kind of ethics and becomes a power luster. In contrast to that progressive worldview, and of course they don't all have that to the extreme, but if you want to understand ideas, you got to understand where they ultimately go, right? Where they lead. In contrast to that worldview is what I would call the classical liberal libertarian view of the world, expressed, I think, profoundly by Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Each individual's moral right to their own life. Each individual's moral right to the pursuit of their personal happiness. Each individual's moral right to the product of their labor. If you produce a lot, you get a lot, including the right to give it away to whoever you want to for whatever reason you want to. If you think about that moral prerogative, it demands personal responsibility, it rewards self-discipline, and it rewards rationality. It's not surprising that you have a successful society based on that kind of ethical view. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As libertarians, we are primarily advocates of liberty. Now, most people are advocates of liberty in some sense, but I don't think a lot of people really understand how critically important liberty is to human well-being. Liberty is essential not only to economic well-being, it is also essential to spiritual well-being. On the economic front, in order to be productive, an individual must be able to think for themselves. They must be able to pursue what they think works. If somebody makes you act like 2 + 2 = 5, you literally cannot think. And most government rules and regulations force people to act like 2 + 2 = 5. In addition, all human progress, by definition, is based on innovation and creativity. Because unless somebody does something better, which will be different, there can be no progress. Innovation and creativity is only possible to independent thinkers. Somebody that thinks like the crowd cannot be innovative, cannot be creative, cannot contribute to human progress. That's why entrepreneurs are so important. Entrepreneurs take the ideas of scientists and engineers and turn them into reality. Without entrepreneurship, there is no human progress. And if you think about entrepreneurs, what characterizes them? They're independent thinkers. They do things that other people don't see. They have insights. They experiment. They fail a lot. For every Google, there's 10,000 failed Googles. And in order to experiment, you have to be free. In order to be able to pursue your truths, you have to have freedom to do it. We published a book about a year and a half ago called Poverty and Progress that looked at human well-being forever. And from the evolution of Homo sapiens about 250,000 years ago until the late 1700s, human life expectancy was basically the same. There were some improvements in the quality of life, but life expectancy was the same. And then in the late 1700s, something happened that was transformational. Human life expectancy in Western civilization went up exponentially and is now starting to move up exponentially in the rest of the world. There was an invention in the late 1700s. It was more important than fire. It was more important than the wheel. It was the invention of the rule of law, of individual rights, of free markets, of capitalism. And today, the single biggest factor correlated with economic well-being on this planet is economic freedom. And the reason that that matters is capitalism provided an ability of people to do things differently, and it provided a reward system for doing that. Free markets, economic freedom, liberty is essential for physical well-being. I would also argue it's essential for spiritual well-being. Spiritual well-being in the sense of the pursuit of happiness. And when I talk about the pursuit of happiness, I'm not talking about having a good time on Friday night, although it may be good to have a good time on Friday night. But I'm talking about happiness in the Aristotelian sense of a life well lived. Blood, sweat, and tears happiness. When you're 80 years old, you can look back and say, man, that was tough, but I'm glad I did it. If you look at happiness in that context, it has to be earned. You cannot be entitled to be happy. You have to earn happiness by having goals for yourself, for pursuing those goals consistent with your beliefs and your values. You have to be free to do that. Being free does not guarantee you will be happy, but not being free guarantees you will not be happy. So liberty is essential for physical well-being, and it's also essential for spiritual well-being. Let's talk about the pursuit of happiness for a minute. The pursuit of happiness is the transformational idea in the Declaration of Independence. Before Jefferson, before the thinkers of the Enlightenment, everybody existed for somebody else's good. Good to the king, good to the state, good to the church. Jefferson said each of us has the moral right to pursue our personal happiness. We're not guaranteed that success, but we have that right. That is the idea that created the most successful and the most benevolent society in history. When people have the right to their own lives, they're naturally nicer to other people. Let's talk about the pursuit of happiness in another way, because if you think about it, that is a very selfish idea. I'm going to pursue my personal happiness. How selfish can you be, right? And selfish is bad, right? That's what we hear all the time. Selfish is bad. Well, let's talk about that a second. I can see Johnny in the sandbox, 3 years old, playing with his truck, not bothering anybody. Along comes Fred. Fred would like to have Johnny's truck. Johnny doesn't want to give Fred his truck. A debate, discussion, argument ensues. Mom, dad, Sunday school teacher, kindergarten teacher gets involved in that argument. And Mom says, hey, Johnny, give that truck to Fred. Don't be selfish. Don't be bad. Two great moral lessons being taught right there in the sandbox. First, where did Fred get the right to Johnny's truck? Are you surprised now Fred would like a Ranger, Ford Ranger, paid for by Johnny through the tax system, right? Interesting lesson for Fred. What about the lesson for Johnny? And I would argue probably everybody in this room is Johnny. This is probably a room of Johnny's. What lessons you learned there in the sandbox? Don't go for what you really believe in. Somehow your life is secondary to other people. For some undefined reason, you have this obligation to Fred to provide him with a truck. Let's talk about acting in one's rational self-interest, properly understood. Immutable, non-negotiable fact of reality. Everything that is alive has to act in its self-interest or die. A lion has to hunt or starve. A deer has to run from the hunter or be eaten. Trees shade out other trees to get sunlight. Amoeba take chemicals that other amoeba would like to have. Life is by definition self-sustaining action. Anything that's alive that quits sustaining its life dies. That is how Mother Nature designed the system. To say that man is bad because he's selfish is saying he's bad because he's alive. Let's talk a little more about acting in one's rational self-interest, because we get this false dichotomy. And the false dichotomy is to take advantage of other people or self-sacrifice, neither one of which make any sense. In fact, a lot of people, when they talk about selfish, think it's about taking advantage of other people. Here's the irony. Taking advantage of other people is not selfish, it's self-destructive. It's self-destructive on two planes. First, you might fool Tom, Dick, and Harry, but they're going to tell Sue, Jane, and Fred, and nobody's going to trust you. And if you're not trusted, you're not going to be successful, and you're certainly not going to be happy. And I'm sure you know some people like that. In addition, if you let go of reality, trying to manipulate, fool somebody else, you're going to do a lot more damage to your subconscious than you do to theirs. Taking advantage of other people is not in your self-interest. It's self-destructive. How about self-sacrifice? That is the moral code of our society, right? You hear it in church, you hear it in school, you hear it on TV. We all should self-sacrifice, right? I want you to ask yourself this question, and for those of you that have children, ask yourself how you would like your children to answer this question. Do you have as much right to your life as anybody has to their life? Do you have as much right to your life as anybody else has to their life? Of course you do. Why would you believe anything different than that? And by the way, if you don't have a right to your life, then nobody has a right to their life. Because there are only you, I's in this room, right? If you're unwilling to defend your right to your life, then you can't defend anybody's right to their life. And that's when the collectives and statists show up to do what's in the common good. So your unwillingness to defend unequivocally your right to the pursuit of your personal happiness prevents the defense of ideas that I think most of us find very valuable. So taking advantage of other people and self-sacrifice make no sense. However, there is a rigorous, demanding moral code that underlies free and successful societies. And that moral code is that fundamentally we're traders. We trade value for value. We get better together. In our business, when I was running BB&T, our goal was to help our clients be economically successful, and we expected to make a profit doing it. Life is about figuring out how to get better together. There are only two stable relationship conditions, win-win and lose-lose. Whenever you get greedy and you set up a win-lose, your partner will get bitter. You see this in spousal relationships, and you'll end up in a lose-lose relationship. Interesting enough, whenever you get self-sacrificial and you set up a lose-win relationship, you'll get bitter, and you end up in a lose-lose relationship. So in any meaningful relationship in your life, you should ask, what's in it for me? That's a fair question. But you should also ask, what's in it for them? Because if at the end of the day there's nothing in it for them, there'll be nothing in it for you. Life is about figuring out how to get better together by creating win-win relationships. And of course it's in your rational self-interest to help the people you care about, your family, your friends, the people you work with, the people you value. If you love your children, helping your children is not a sacrifice. In fact, love is the ultimate expression of selfishness. Now, most people don't see that. I tell college students this story. You're getting ready to get married. Obviously a big event in your life. Your spouse comes running up to you and says, honey, I'm so excited about marrying you. This is the biggest self-sacrifice I've ever made. Not exactly what you want to hear, right? I believe it is in my rational self-interest to support the United Way, United Way is an umbrella charity organization that does a lot of good in the community. I wouldn't want to live in the kind of community that would exist without United Way, and I wouldn't want my children to live in that kind of community. So I believe it is in my rational self-interest to support the United Way. So what would actually be required for you to act in your rational self-interest, to genuinely pursue your happiness? You'd have to have a sense of purpose. You'd take care of your body. You'd eat properly. You'd exercise. You'd take care of your mind. You'd read, study. You'd think. You'd work hard to create relationships with other human beings that shared your values. And you'd have a rational value system. What if everybody had a sense of purpose? Did the best they could to take care of their body, did the best they could to take care of their mind, worked hard to create a healthy relationship with people who shared their values, and had a rational value system? What if everybody acted in their rational self-interest? I would argue that 90% of the world's problems would go away. You constantly hear that the problem is that people are selfish. My observation is very few people are consistently selfish. Very few people actually consistently act in their rational self-interest. Most people are self-destructive in some aspect of their life. I had a brother-in-law, drank 24 beers a day, got cirrhosis of the liver, drank 24 beers a day, died. People say he was selfish. No, he was self-destructive. Bernie Madoff, the guy that stole billions of dollars from his family and friends, he said the best day in his life is when he got caught. Can you imagine spending your life stealing from your family and friends? He was a miserable human being. He wasn't selfish, he was self-destructive. In order to defend a free society, we must be willing to defend everybody's right, including our right, to pursue happiness. Pursue happiness. Not using force or fraud to take advantage of anybody else, but living our lives on our own terms. I'll share with you a couple more thoughts on happiness. The foundation for happiness is real self-esteem, not the fake stuff they try to sell today, but real self-esteem. And real self-esteem has a number of characteristics. First, self-esteem is fundamentally self-confidence in your ability to live and be successful given the facts of reality. So you earn self-esteem by how you live your life. Nobody can give you self-esteem. You cannot give anybody self-esteem. You cannot give your children self-esteem. Self-esteem has to be earned. Live your life with integrity. Raise your self-esteem. That's why integrity matters. One other thought about self-esteem. In the real world, the primary sources of self-esteem are romantic love and productive work. Now, romantic love is probably a survival of the species instinct. I am not an expert on romantic love, but I will share one observation with you. If you're looking for somebody to make you happy, you will fail, because nobody can make you happy. If you're looking for somebody to share your happiness with, you will be successful, because there are a lot of people looking to share happiness. Productive work, and I use productive work in the broadest context. Raising children is very productive. Productive work for the people in this room is the primary source of your self-esteem, because you spend a disproportionate amount of time, effort, and energy at work. And work is important because it does define your and drive your self-esteem. Something I said many times to the employees of BB&T, it's real important to BB&T that you do your job well, but it's far, far more important to you. You might fool me about how well you do your job. You might fool your boss about how well you do your job, but you'll never fool you. If you don't do your work the best you can do it, give me your level of skill, give me your level of knowledge. You can't do the impossible, but if you don't do your work the best you can do it, give me your level of skill, give me your level of knowledge, you will lower your self-esteem. The good news is the flip's true. Do your work the best you can do it. Give them your level of skill, give them your level of knowledge, and you will raise your self-esteem, which is more important than whether you get a promotion or you get more money, because it's about your character. It's about who you are. And there's a major societal implication to that concept. Take a construction worker, bricklayer, has a really tough, grinding life. My granddad had that kind of life, really tough, grinding life. He has a really tough, grinding life, but he and his wife successfully raise their children. Maybe his granddaughter becomes CEO of a publicly traded company, maybe not. He has a tough, grinding life, but he gets something very precious from his work. He gets to be proud of himself. He gets self-esteem. Take that same bricklayer and give him welfare. He may be better off financially, but he loses a piece of his soul. Piece of his soul. You know, in Washington now, particularly the progressives, but everybody talks about security. It's a false kind of discussion of security because what they want to be is secure from reality, which is very hard to be. But even if it were true, it would be the wrong discussion. Americans care about security, but this is not the land of security. People didn't get on a boat and come to Jamestown to be secure. The United States is the land of opportunity. The opportunity to be great, the opportunity to fail and try again, but most importantly, the opportunity of that bricklayer to live life on his own terms, to pursue his personal happiness based on his beliefs and his values, to pursue his happiness as a free and independent person. That's why people came to America. That sense of life is what made America great. And that sense of life is what's so important for us to protect. Thank you very much. I would be glad to answer questions about anything anybody wants to talk about. Yes, sir. Hey, Yvonne. Thank you.
So Cato was doing a great job here at following amicus briefs.
Yes.
And reasons pleased to join with Cato from time to time. What are your favorite cases that Cato has contributed to in the past few years, and what's on the drawing board as far as you know? And I know that's
right.
At the level of Elia and Hodges.
Thank you for that. I don't know how many people know this, but our scholars, in my view, really re-energized the argument about enumerated powers in the Constitution, whereas the conservatives actually had given that up, ironically, and our scholars have done that. And we've been following up that, trying to remind the Supreme Court that, hey, Congress only has 18, I think it is, enumerated powers, and they need to be enforced. And we filed amicus briefs, and in the last session of the Supreme Court, we won 10 out of 11 times. Way better than anybody else. In the session before that, we won 15 out of 18, which we view as a movement towards libertarian view on the court. Now, unfortunately, a lot of these wins are just about an inch, you know, but they are an inch. The cases that are important to me, I'm a big advocate of gun rights, and I thought we were really, Bob Levy, our chairman, was very instrumental in the gun rights case. And having run a business, I think free speech for businesses is pretty important, and we were instrumental in that case. I'm proud of the work we've done for gay rights, and this is interesting because a lot of people think of Cato because we kind of line up often with conservatives on economic issues, but we don't line up on social issues, and we, for a long time, have been arguing for gay rights. And our basic argument is kind of different. We just say that marriage is none of the business of the government. Where'd that come from? people have the right to contract. Isn't that what the Constitution says? And if you have the right to contract, you don't lose it because of your sexual preferences. So we don't believe actually in gay rights. We believe in individual rights. And gays are individuals who don't lose their rights because of their sexual preferences. And I think that argument has actually struck home with the Supreme Court because it's really a contractual argument about individual rights versus about people's sexual preferences. We've been very instrumental in fighting for marijuana. We won in some courts, but we hadn't exactly won what I'd like to see because we think marijuana is good or bad for you, but because we believe adults get to do things that other people believe are bad for them, including smoking marijuana. And that's what freedom's all about, is people being able to do things, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else, doing what they believe they would enjoy doing. Yes, sir.
Thanks for an excellent talk.
Thank you.
The problem I've encountered is people seem to, it seems that the left, the Democrats, are sort of maybe built two main component parts. One is the sort of progressives that you mentioned, who have this often academic, ideological commitment to just sort of taking wealth from people and giving it away. But I feel,
okay.
But I feel that the second group of people, maybe the working class Democrats, are people who largely agree with philosophically what you say. But, you know, maybe they have a child who is autistic or someone who came down with sort of an overwhelmingly costly disease, and they say, well, my exception is the thing that sort of ought to change the rules. And, you know, I think that, you know, Cato has sort of brought up some really interesting responses to that. I remember one of your scholars talked about a synthesis of Hayek and Rawls, reading something about that in the Cato Unbound. And I also see some really interesting developments in, or maybe I've just noticed more in the past years, how the liberal Democrats came to power in the UK, and the Free Democrats seem to always see be a deciding factor in German politics. Is there room for some kind of safety net within libertarianism, or is that completely inconsistent? And I know David Beto's done some really great work on mutual aid societies. I've read his books. I kind of want to do like a talk with him or a podcast. Mm-hmm. But I think that those mutual aid societies are contingent on people having something to contribute to begin with and don't really address maybe the concerns of people. I just kind of want to throw out this yeah. problem that seems to come up over and over again.
I don't believe a government-funded safety net is consistent with libertarian ideals. If you're going to use force, and once you sanction the use of force, where's the line? So where's the safety net? It ends up with egalitarianism. I know a lot of conservatives argue, well, it ought to be here. What's the logic of that? Why wouldn't it be everybody's equal? So I don't think a government-funded safety net based on force is a legitimate libertarian idea. Because it's the use of force. Now, I'm a huge advocate of charity. I think there's a lot of roles for charity. And in the United States, the amount of charity we have, if it actually were going to poor people, it'd be about $100,000 per poor person. It's the way the charity gets consumed in the United States, not the quantity of charity. I also argue, and I feel strongly, that in a free society, first, we'd have a radically better education system than we have today. Government-run school system is a miserable failure, and we'd have much better education system, and it'd be very different. And the reason that many kids can't be productive, they don't learn how to think in the school system, and that's a government-created problem. I think if you had a real competitive system where you subsidize maybe through vouchers, you'd have real innovation. There's a Sam Walton out there or Bill Gates who would radically change education. Competition would be huge. So I think in a free society, the number of people that would face these problems would be relatively small, and charity would easily take care of them. And I think, you know, before the government showed up, a lot of this stuff was done. And let's look at the welfare system. We published statistics on it. It has absolutely destroyed minority families and low-income families in the United States with huge negative social consequences for those families. It is the enemy of poor people, and it's because it's based on force. Voluntary associations, I work with Goodwill Industries. They do a phenomenal job of improving by teaching people to be personally responsible instead of being entitled. And that mindset is hugely important, not just to economic well-being, but to how happy people are. Well, if you look at welfare recipients, they commit suicide, they rob each other, they use dope. It's all kind of terrible stuff because of the nature of that kind of entitled mentality and the lack of personal responsibility that comes from it. So I'm personally opposed to government safety nets, and I think charity is very important. And I think if we really had a free society, we'd have a radically better school system, and there wouldn't be that many people anyway. And not only would they be economically better off, they'd be spiritually better off in that context. Yes, sir.
I think that if progressives had their way, there would be no need for charity. And I think that's the direction they're going.
Yes.
And progressives and Democrats make a big thing about separation of church and state. But I consider their goals of government charity to be taken from religions. And has anyone proposed the argument that rather than separation of church and state, there should be separation of charity and state? Because many of these progressives have taken the principles of religion and removed the God and then pursued their their positions.
I think that's a very good insight. Many progressives are atheists, but somehow they've held on to the Christian argument without all the else that goes with it. So they've held on to that part of the argument. If you look at Western Europe, where they have much bigger government, there's much less charity. And one thing that bothers me a lot, and you are in the legal system can see this better than I can probably, at one time liberals were strong, adamant defenders of freedom of speech. And I see freedom of religion kind of connected to freedom of speech. It's an expression in the same way. Now they are not. They're the enemies of freedom. All this politically correct movement on college campuses, they have become the enemies of freedom of speech. In other words, you can say what you want as long as you don't disagree with the progressive agenda, right? As long as you don't advance religious ideas. They used to be defenders of freedom of religion. Now they've become the opposite. They're the enemies of freedom of religion by other people that have, by Baptists or Catholics. And it's really been a flip that's happened in my lifetime. And it's the movement from liberals to progressive. And they become very strong enemies of freedom of speech and freedom of religion, where it used to be, by the way, the religious people that were opposed to freedom of religion. They wanted everybody to have their religion, right? There's still some of that, but that's much less of a force today than the progressives want you not to have a religion or not to have religious expression, or not to be free to see religion in your own terms. So I think it's a very negative movement from liberal to progressive, in my view. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I have a somewhat of a pragmatic question.
Okay.
In terms of changing public opinion in this country, I believe that it seriously comes down to talking to your neighbors and friends and people in your community. What do you find is the most persuasive argument when talking to people that truly believe that raising the tax level will help society and promote freedom?
Yeah, I think it depends on the individual. What I tend to focus on is to concretize the issue of the use of force, which most people will not sanction, but they somehow sanction at the macro level. I'll use the example. What if we're living in a neighborhood and there are 10 families in the neighborhood. One family's making more money than the other. Six people in the neighborhood vote to take guns and take the money from the neighbor and give it to the poor neighbor. Would you be one of the people willing to take guns and use a gun to take it from your wealthier neighbor? Most people, including progressives, would not. Well, what is the difference in principle than 400 people in Washington, D.C. voting to do that? My book tries to take, I believe, the arguments for a libertarian political philosophy come from the ideals that many of us would accept as appropriate individual behavior. And somehow in our translation from individual behavior to group behavior, we do things that we would never sanction as an individual for ourselves. So that's how I try. You know, some people you're not going to convince. but what I find is that people that are more neutral, maybe not progressive, they say, well, you know, maybe that's a point. It's about, you can focus on the use of force and that distinction as being, you know, do you really sanction the use of force? And would you do it?
Right. Thank you.
That's what I do.
I'd like to have your thoughts on free enterprise. I assume that everyone in this room is pretty much for free enterprise, including myself. And as I told some, I'm a patent attorney, but I incidentally also wound up as a director of a publicly traded corporation. And in 2008, subsequent to that, we were very successful. We had about $300 million in the bank, which I believe was a capitalistic institution that might have even been publicly traded. And we were told that we could not have access to this money, that it was frozen, and that we could take a loan against it, all right? But the system was frozen. And the U.S. taxpayer and Hank Paulson, God love him, and Geithner and Bernanke, they pulled the system out of the, you know. So we have, my view, we got welfare for the wealthy, and not so, well, we give a little bit to the poor and, you know, try and educate them and bring them on. But I don't know, we got, you know, we helped the corporations out. I didn't want the company to do a depression, which would have been 30s all over again. What's your thoughts on that?
Multiple thoughts. I wrote a book on this, so let's go to the context. I'll take two issues. If I were in charge, I would cut off corporate welfare first, long before I'd get rid of food stamps. I mean, Boeing gets massive subsidies from the U.S. government, and that would be where I'd start with Boeing. But, okay. So, and I think we look like hypocrites when we support corporate welfare, what I call cronyism, or what you can call crony capitalism. And it is a growing problem. It's a growing problem because the progressives actually aren't opposed to it. They're using it. They're using it because they really have much more of what's called a corporatist, or you have to be careful using this in public, a fascist model. They realize socialism doesn't work because when it doesn't work, the government gets blamed. They would rather people appear to own private businesses and they control the businesses, which is exactly what's happening in the banking sector. You know, the banking sector is fundamentally now controlled by the federal government, and it's a form of corporatism. So progressives, interestingly enough, aren't really opposed to cronyism because they want to control the businesses too. But businesses that go up and ask for favors, I think they're anti-free market. And they do it all the time, and that's our problem because we have that much hypocrisy. But I will return to the financial crisis. I was the longest serving CEO of a major financial institution in the U.S. We didn't have a single quarterly loss during the financial crisis. We went through every quarter. We made money through the financial crisis. The perception of the financial crisis is totally wrong. It's one of the stories we've got to change. The story is that the financial crisis was caused by deregulation of the banking industry and greed on Wall Street. Well, the banking industry was not deregulated. George Bush was not a capitalist. We had three massive new regulations, the Patriot Act, the Privacy Act, and Sarbanes-Oxley. It was a huge increase in regulation in the industry during George Bush. We were just misregulated. There was no deregulation. That's a myth. The second thing, greed on Wall Street. I've been in the banking business 40 years. There's been absolute maximum greed on Wall Street every day. To say there was more greed in 2006 than there was any other time is just ridiculous. I mean, there's always 100% greed on Wall Street. That's a non-expedition. The financial crisis was primarily caused by government policy. The two primary culprits were the Federal Reserve and government housing policy, Freddie and Fannie, government sanctioned entities. The Federal Reserve in the early 2000s, there was a guy named Alan Greenspan, who was head of the Federal Reserve. He was a maestro, remember that? And he didn't want to go out on a bad note. We were having the dot-com bubble was bursting. We were having a correction we needed. And instead of letting the market correct it, he started printing money willy-nilly. He drove down interest rates, which sponsored a bubble, right? And the bubble got focused in the housing market because of the government housing policies, specifically Freddie and Fannie, giant government-sponsored enterprises that under Bill Clinton were forced to have half their loan portfolio in subprime mortgages. When Freddie and Fannie failed, they owed $5 trillion and they had $2 trillion in subprime mortgages. They dominated the subprime mortgage business. So the bubble was caused by the Fed and it ended up in housing because of Freddie and Fannie. Did individual banks make mistakes? Absolutely. Should they have been allowed to fail? Absolutely. Would their failures have crashed the economic system of the U.S.? Absolutely not. That is the most stupid idea. Listen, I was in the back room of the 10th largest bank in the U.S., and we had money coming out the Zubu. And I just talked to Dick Kovacevic, the head of Wells Fargo, another healthy AAA bank. All the healthy banks, but there were only like 8 or 10 banks in fail. Banks fail all the time.
Hey, I'm not a banker, I'm just saying.
The financial system was not going to crash. I went through the early 80s, I went through the early 90s. The early 80s were much worse than the early 90s. They just didn't do that stuff. So they didn't need to bail out Citigroup. Citigroup's been bailed out 3 times in my career. If they hadn't have been bailed out the first 2 times, they wouldn't have been able to be bailed out the 3rd time. They wouldn't have been here to do that. So I think cronyism is a really bad problem. I think it undermines our arguments. I'm opposed to corporate welfare. And government causes a lot of these problems. They certainly caused the recent financial crisis. And I was there and saw it from the inside. I saw the housing bubble develop, and we didn't do it. And so I think I have a pretty good understanding of what happened.
John, we have time for one more question. I'm sure you took, an understanding. But my point is that the government and the banks are united.
I agree, and that's a problem. But the banks are controlled by... It's not free enterprise. We shouldn't have Freddie Mac. We shouldn't have Fannie Mae. We shouldn't have the Federal Reserve. We shouldn't have FDIC insurance. Got one more question?
What would you recommend?
Give somebody else a chance.
Read my book. Anybody else got a question? Yes, sir.
So I love how you praise the idea of people pursuing happiness and their own self-interest. There's a lot of research lately that behavioral economics say that we're actually pretty bad at pursuing our self-interest. So like your brother-in-law kind of thought that was his self-interest. So how does that help us think differently about wanting people to pursue that when we're actually not great at it, maybe?
Well, you know, we as human beings have limitations. That doesn't mean nobody else can fix that problem for you. You can't be entitled to be to be happy. But if people say that you shouldn't pursue your happiness, that you ought to be self-sacrificial, then I see this is a very common thing I see among very successful people. They're very unhappy because at some level they have that sandbox experience and they feel guilty about their own happiness. So I think consciously saying you ought to pursue your personal happiness without taking advantage of other people, without stealing, without fraud, will improve the probability of most human beings being happier. And I think that's all you can do. You know, we're born with a nature and we have to work within the context of our nature. Thank you very much.